Who is that?
Jazz.
Bastard.
All right. Well, we've worked out our living environments. We've worked out our various political hang-ups, and we're ready for Jazz Bastard Podcast 195. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike.
I guess this one was kind of Mike's inspiration to talk a little bit about what I think of as the New York white funk scene of the 70s and the 80s. That was inspired by, we're going to look at a predecessor, a Black Funk album, but then became this kind of weird, I don't know what to call it. You know, we've talked before about Michael Brecker and what I call the Saturday Night Live saxophone sound, right? Which
yeah.
is, you know, both he and David Sanborn are kind of basing themselves, I think, some combination, especially in Brecker's case, of John Coltrane and, you know, soul players. Sanborn certainly pays his props to Hank Crawford, but at some point this became the sound of white funk by musicians with huge technical skills and even larger amounts of cocaine in their systems, and sort of somehow the sound of urban New York. So we're going to look at a predecessor, Donald Byrd's album, Street Lady, from 1973 on Blue Note. And then we're going to look at a recording made in 1980, but only released right now, 2020, the Brecker Brothers Live and Unreleased on Pilu Records. Pilu Records. It's a recently unearthed live show from their pomp. And then we're all going to look at Randy Brecker's Some Skunk Funk, released 2006 on Telarc. It's a 2003 live performance with the, is it WDR Big Band?
That's a good question.
Something like that. Some kind of well-known big band, European big band. And Michael Brecker, the Brecker Brothers, is there as well. David Sanborn's Songs from the Night Before, 1996, on Elektra. So those are the recordings. Do you have a preference as to how we do them, sir?
We could start with Donald Byrd, but one of the theses that I have today is that chronology almost doesn't matter, does it? It's not like this is a sound that feels like it undergoes organic development. It feels kind of timeless or dated, however you want to put it. It just is what it is, you know. I happen to like it. If you hate it, you'll find it dated, I suppose. But it's one of the things I'm struck with, and we'll talk about this, is you know, listening to Randy Brecker's Some Skunk Funk and the Brecker Brothers Live and Unreleased, you really can't tell that 20 years have passed. It's kind of how I feel, you know. It feels real similar. So which either says that they found some perfect idealized form of jazz, or they just stopped developing. I don't know. You take your pick. Anyway, so I don't think it matters where we go, but let's start with Donald Byrd, because I have questions for you about Donald Byrd, and it would be helpful to maybe begin there, since you've posited this album and the sound that it embodies as a kind of ur source, as it were, for the New York sound. We're dubbing the New York. We could call it the Saturday Night Live sound.
There you go.
Right?
The
G.E. Smith Saturday Night Live band sound.
Yeah. Just what the world needs now.
For the kids who don't know, once upon a time, Saturday Night Live was not actually a Zoom meeting. It was a show done live in a studio in New York, live from New York. And in the 80s, the house band was led by this ponytailed wonder named G.E. Smith. And it seemed like that the sound of that band is similar to what we're talking about in this podcast. So that's, if we talk about the G.E. Smith sound, it's because of the Saturday Night Live band sound of that era is what we're talking about. So anyway, so let's start with Donald Byrd and then go wherever you want.
Sure. This is a weird thing in that I've Donald Byrd, some people talk about as being one of the great apostates of the of hard bop, right? He records a lot of albums going back to with G.G. Grice, you know, and then recording a lot on Blue Note and other labels as a hard bop trumpeter. And then at some point, he starts releasing highly produced kind of soul funk jazz albums. And really, in a sense, the mastermind of Street Lady, as well as some of his other releases, are the Mizzle Brothers, Fonts and Larry. And these guys are producers, basically active in the 70s. Wikipedia lists their productions from 72 to 81. And really, they're trailing off after the mid-70s. And they work with Bobby Humphrey and Donald Byrd at Blue Note. And they work on other labels, Motown and Mercury. And they kind of turn jazz into what AllMusic describes as the soundtrack to a blaxploitation film, which is not unfair. And
no, it isn't. It actually is fair. Sorry, that's just really apposite. I like
that. Yeah, it's right on point. This is not, you know, Donald Byrd is a trumpet player. I've always thought of a moderate interest. He's certainly technically secure, but he's not a genius. You know, I broke down when it got cheap enough and got the 8-album set of Coltrane 58 on Prestige. That's some of my favorite Coltrane, and Byrd appears on a lot of those albums, and it's like John Coltrane and Donald Byrd. You know, he's pretty young there. But, you know, it's like a genius and a pretty good bop trumpeter.
A genius. And another guy.
And another guy, you know, and he's pretty young, and you know, but I don't, you know, Byrd is good. He's not a Freddie Hubbard. He's not a Lee Morgan. He doesn't have quite that much personality, and he makes a lot of records. He makes a lot with Pepper Adams, the baritone saxophone player, and I got an album that he did with Pepper, and I can't remember his art form or who it is, and you know, it's good, but he himself is not. Exactly, a musical genius, and he starts teaching, and he hooks up with a bunch of younger students, and I think one of the Mizzells, or maybe both, were his students, and then they went into production, and he's like, okay, I'm going to jump ship here. I'm going to, you know, give up the hard bop life and go over to this highly produced, you know, funk soul music. And Street Lady is a 6-track record. There are vocals on a couple of the tracks. It's extraordinarily funky. It's a production. It's not a group. So you got Roger Glenn on flute, Jerry Peters piano, and of course, electric piano, given the era. Fonts Mizzle on clavinet, trumpet, and vocals. Fred Perrin, synthesizer vocals. David Walker, guitar. Chuck Rainey, electric bass. And then a couple percussionists. Harvey Mason on drums. King Erickson and Steven Spruell on percussion. And Larry Mizzle does vocals, and he's also the arranger and the conductor. So yeah, this is a... It's a production, and
it's
groovy. And the weirdest thing is, so like, one thing that happened after the various labels ate one another is that Blue Note started relabeling albums made on other labels as Blue Note recordings. So like United Artists released like Money Jungle by Mingus. We've talked about that, Ellington and Roach, or the Undercurrent, the great album by Jim Hall and Bill Evans, you know, those are United Artists productions that later get rebadged as Blue Note. For some reason, I have a pristine LP copy of Street Lady, which was a Blue Note release, on Pacific Jazz. I mean, it's so weird. It's a generic cover with a wave on it. And these names, it's like, but it was never on Pacific Jazz. And Pacific Jazz is a label that Blue Note ate. And intermittently, you know, would rebadge things or release them as Pacific Jazz, but I don't understand the rationale as to why this was re-released as a quote-unquote Pacific Jazz release when, you know, it had nothing to do with Pacific. It had nothing to do with the 50s white cool jazz scene. It was a Blue Note release from the early 70s, but there it was. And I dug it up somewhere and I said, my God, okay, let's listen to this. Sounds great. It is, if you get into production and bathing in that 70s sound, I think it's a lot of fun.
Thank you.
just not a great showpiece of trumpet playing. So, thoughts about this predecessor to the New York white funk sound?
Oftentimes we shit on the Penguins, or maybe I shit on the Penguins, maybe a little more than you do. But this time they have a note that I think is really opposite. It's really appropriate. They quote someone and say, Donald Byrd at this era wasn't selling out, he was buying in.
Okay.
And I think that's just about right. They point out that his talent as an improviser was declining, and I think that's fair. I think that's just. And he wisely has found a setting in which what abilities, diminished abilities, he still has, are perfectly well suited for his environment. I actually like this sound quite a bit. I mean, it is the soundtrack to, like, you know, 70s TV, you know, it's like Beretta, you know, or Starsky and Hutch, you know, I mean, it's blaxploitation. It's terrific. I love the synths. I love the rhythm, all the percussion shit, you know, the hyperactive percussion shit. I especially like the prominent use of flute.
Yeah, it's very 70s, yeah.
Prominent use of flute and rhythm guitar. I think David Bowie once, I've quoted this before on the podcast, David Bowie famously said, you know, if he could have had any other job, he would have liked to have been a saxophone player in Little Richard's band. I've often thought the best job in the world would be a rhythm guitarist from the 70s in one of James Brown's bands or any of these bands, because all you have to do is know like three chords and you just play deep, 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 deep. That's all you do. And it's all the cocaine you could possibly want. You know, I mean, what a great life. And the rhythm guitarist here, I mean, that is all he fucking does. Like, he is not asked to do anything except strum along and be part of this churning engine. And the only people who are really doing work here, you know, I think, are the percussionist and the flautist. And everyone else is just phoning it in. But it's great. I mean, it's all phoned in and smooth and cool. It's like, we've got this funk groove engine, and occasionally the piano player gets some, and occasionally the flute player gets some, and every now and again Donald Byrd pokes his head out and he does some trills and riffs, and that's it. That's all you need. And this is awesome. I mean, I don't think it's brilliant, but I like it a lot. And then, of course, you know, for outros, you have like groovy four-person choruses just sort of going, ooh, ah.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
Street
I mean,
lady.
Street lady, you know, it's awesome. I really like this, but it is definitely low hanging fruit. This is like this weird place where, you know, I guess fusion and funk sort of meet elevator music, but not quite. And it's just this, you know, real smooth potpourri of palatable funk. It's not hard-hitting funk, right? I mean, this isn't like, it's like, it's not, you're not going to get any of that.
No, it's no. Just, yeah, it's not James Brown, you know, no.
Not James Brown. It's not even, I've been listening to some of Prince's piano and a microphone, and it's like he's channeling the soul of James Brown half the time. He's all about the,
he's more tightly wound, yeah.
Yeah, he's more tightly wound. There's no here. This is all in, yeah. Put on your aviator shades, get on your platforms and just groove the fuck out. I like it. It's not brilliant, but I find this incredibly pleasant and very easy to listen to. And I'm not, you know, there are moments that I could imagine you'd listen to it, you'd go, well, this is risible. This is funny. But I'm kind of down with it. I none of those moments really bother me. Woman of the World might be maybe the worst of these moments.
Yeah, it's unctuous, isn't it? Yeah.
It is unctuous, but I'm at this point, it's like, I've got the baby oil, I'm happy, you know, it's all good at this point. And the Penguin shit on Byrd, but I think he's a little, I mean, he is diminished, but he's still good. He's still got some fire.
Well, I wonder, you know, he's not like this guy's ancient or something. So, you know, whether it's, as I said, I think that in a way, it's like to overstress how great he was as a hard bop player is a mistake. And then in the genre, he's born 1932. So he is a slightly different generation than the rest of our musicians who are born around 45. But, you know, I think it's more that just, he's in a genre where if you try too hard, you fail. You know, you can't you can't be ripping off Dizzy Gillespie lines here. It's going to ruin the groove. So, yeah, I mean, what more is he expected to do? I mean, he shouldn't be doing more than he's doing because it's not really about him. Yeah.
The person I think he reminds me of the most here is, especially if he had busted out a flugelhorn, he reminds me at times of Art Farmer, the way he kind of plays against the groove and stuff. Now, he's not, you know, Art Farmer's, you know, a much better player. But some of the licks Bird gets in here, I'm like, this sounds like something that someone who's been working with G.G. Grice could be playing, you know?
And Farmer, you know, he plays on productions. You know, we've talked about one of them, and I got another one, the Crawl Space, with Will Lee on bass, who appears in the Brecker Brothers, where he is playing in the 70s style. Now, it's a little, there's more jazz content, there's more fiber, and as I said, somehow Art Farmer never loses his dignity. Where, you know, Donald Byrd's like, open for business, red light's on, you know? It's like, dignity be damned. You know, it's just like, you get, there's no sense he's trying to... He's just like, here I am. So, but you know, it's not a wildly different. It's just that the productions on CTI that Farmer appear on are just, there's a lot more jazz to them. They're just a little bit higher level. You know, they're not quite so pandering. Yeah.
That's really funny. I like the way you put that. That was really good.
Well, and you know, someday I got this. I've been fascinated by the Blue Note LP reissue system. They did a whole bunch of 75 anniversary reissues that sucked. They were digital copies. They were noisy often, just bad examples of the LP art. And so they kind of said mea culpa and went with the Tone Poet series, which is in theory $35 a pop. But really, when you go out shopping or go to Amazon, it's never that much. And then the 80th anniversary, which is cheaper yet, you know, 25, but I mean, they have a lot of 30% sales at the store. You get them $19-$20, and these are all pure analog, good pressing, just fucking fantastic sounding albums. And I got one led by Bird with Pepper and some third instrumentalist. And someday we should put in a good hard bop album by Bird, because this is not, you know, this is not him at his best. And again, I don't know whether it's literally a decline in his powers or just an abandonment of hard bop aesthetics and discipline when he realized I don't need to play this well. You know, I can kind of coast along these arrangements and get the job done. I don't know. This album is a time capsule. I like it. You do have to reconcile yourself to the idea that there will be no development.
Right.
They're going to set up a groove and they're going to follow that groove for 6 to 8 minutes and then they're going to end that groove. But there really isn't. It's not an event-filled music. It's not about tension and release. It's about, you know, the Baby Oil. And if you get released, it's up to you, buddy. But, you know, we don't know what track it's going to happen. You know, so
release not included.
Right. Yeah, you're on your own there, bud. Find your own street lady.
Oh, man.
I didn't know that we'd ever talk about it. But then, you know, when you're interested in doing some Brecker Brothers stuff in Sanborn, I thought, well, you know, this is kind of the daddy of that stuff. I would argue that it is a little less tightly wound and fraught and technocratic than the white stuff that follows.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Especially the Brecker Brothers stuff.
Yeah, they're a little more. They got a little more. They got some boards up their butts that Donald Byrd is just like, relax, man.
I can't play that well. I don't need to. And
it's just not that important. Yeah.
I use cocaine in moderation. Everything is fine.
That's right.
Street lady. Yeah, it is. There's a camp value to this stuff. And yeah, one thing I recognize as we were preparing for the show is like, okay, I can't listen to this playlist through because it's too fucking much. And I love funk. It's too much funk, you know. It's
like, too much funk.
Too much funk. You know, I didn't know. I've hit my funk limit, you know. it's the needle's pointing to F for funk, and it's gone a little over there. But yeah, I mean, just as a kind of a, I don't say mindless, but maybe I do, you know, groove album. This is fun, and it is. I just think I've reached a point. I don't know that the culture has, but I think to some degree of appreciating and celebrating 70s production just as a bath you can soak yourself in, that we realize at times doesn't have a hell of a lot of content to it, and maybe might not have been cutting edge musically speaking, but is this gorgeous sound.
Yeah.
And you know, we used to take it for granted. In the 70s it was everywhere, and people got tired of disco, and people got, you know, but now it's like it's this lost nirvana. Before compression, before digitalization, when live musicians walked the earth and made popular music for popular consumption, it sounds so good. And this is an example of that. I think it sounds great. Well, I guess my impulse would be to go chronologically, not by date of release, because if we go to this 1980 live joint by the Brecker Brothers, it's brand new. This is the new album that one of our fine publicity people got to us to take a look at. Brecker Brothers Live and Unreleased is coming out this year on, as I said, PILOO Records, PILU or PILU Records. And it's a good, solid two-disc set of the Brecker Brothers at their peak. And I found some things that I had not realized. They released six albums on Arista Records, or Arista, I'm never sure. And apparently the label asked them to form a band. So it had not occurred to them. And I think for most jazz musicians, Michael Brecker is the name we know best. He's the monster on the tenor sax. Randy is a very accomplished musician, but as a trumpet player, I don't find him as immediately identifiable or charismatic or as jaw-dropping. But he's kind of the mastermind of the group. He does most of the compositions. He's the older brother. You get the feeling he was the wild card, the extrovert. So, this, as I said, is a kind of a massive trawl through their six LPs of material, live and unreleased. What do you think of this one?
So, mainly because of Michael Brecker in recent years, you know, I hadn't picked about. I mean, obviously the standout here is Michael Brecker. He is a monstrously good player. And probably with his tragic early death, he's becoming even more lionized now than he was during his lifetime. It's not like he was short of any critical attention when he was alive, but my sense is that he is someone who is really kind of being canonized now, and for better or for worse. I don't have any brief against the cult of St. Michael. I don't know if it's entirely... I don't know. I mean, I like him a lot. I'm not as a rabid a fan as I think some people are. What's impressive here is this is a unit that is really well put together, isn't it? They sound great. And it's the same template that you had with Donald Byrd, right? It's largely this percussive rhythmic groove that's established by the rhythm section over which Randy and Michael do their shit. A lot more soloing.
A lot more soloing takes place. I mean, there's the groove goes on, but a hell of a lot of this
huge
high octane blowing over it.
And I guess this was a revelation a little bit to me. You know, I've heard other Randy Brecker albums, and I like them, but I was like, oh, wow, he's better than I knew. I mean, I was a little impressed here by him. I was like, I didn't realize he was as good as this, which sounds like damnation by faint praise. It's just that I only knew him through studio albums, which, you know, are fine, but I think some of his live playing here is quite on point and fiery. He's not the lesser Brecker here, you know, he's... it's more equal, you know. It really feels like it's not the Randy band with Michael featuring Michael Brecker. It's like it really is the Brecker Brothers. They both are kind of featured equally here, and he holds up quite well. I could have done with a little less of the wankery that occurs on some of the songs.
No kidding.
Yeah. Oh, God. So by wankery, I mean some of the treated electronic bullshit that goes on, mainly because the brothers are so good and the groove is so good. And then you get some weird, I don't even know what are they doing? Do you know what they're doing sometimes? It sounds like there's some sort of electronic ass hattery going on.
Right. They release a live album on Arista called Heavy Metal Bebop. And on that album and on this album, they are using effects pedals at times and processing the sound of their horns. And then, of course, the keyboard player has a pitch bender, which I think should have been taken from him and his hand slapped. And then there's at least one solo where the bass player is just, where he just goes on minute after minute. Processing the sound and just Will Lee, you know, and it's just, it's amazing technically, but my God, it is wankery. You know, it's like, good Lord. Okay. But yeah, when the boys put their horns through those pedals, it's interesting. I don't know that it's aesthetically that successful. It's weird. The Brecker Brothers, one way you could talk about them is they're a fusion band, right? You know, when you think of the major fusion bands of the 70s, they're all so different. We think of them as the electric period of jazz, and we went away from electricity thanks to Wynton Marsalis and his, you know, pledge of purity. I will not touch any electrons. But, you know, Weather Report from Mahavishnu, from Brecker Brothers, from, you know, there's not a lot in common as to what they're fusing exactly. There's very different approaches. And here, it's really about these kind of supercharged, cocainized Ray Charles moves and Hank Crawford moves, but they do bring in the electronics and it doesn't really fit. They're not a spacey band. They aren't really about texture.
No, it's so weird. It's so weird. Yeah.
It's like Pink Floyd. They don't listen to Pink Floyd. They never met Pink. They don't like Pink Floyd. So what's the point in processing the sound of your horn when you're not really going after those effects? I don't know. I mean, it's something to do. It's like, well, you know, Michael's got another 10 billion notes to play, so let's make 5 billion of them, you know, through a processor. And I don't know. I don't get the point of it. And again, the synthesizer player really needed some kind of timeout in the corner. It's like, no. Bad. No.
The only thing I would say about this is a recording next to the live thing is, I'll bet listening to this live was awesome. It's just that listening to it as a recording, I'm like, I don't need to listen to this all the time. I get tired. There's a great review that talks about on one of these songs that it's, you know, 18 minutes long, 10 minutes, it's about 10 minutes too long, which is the exact length of Michael Brecker's unaccompanied solo. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of fair. You know?
Oh, God.
If I was in a club listening to this live, I would, you know, have an orgasm. But listening to it on headphones repeatedly, I'm like, okay, you know, could we wrap this up sooner? You know, it's like, I got it. You guys are really good. It's wankery, less the passion. It feels more like, I don't feel like they're communicating feeling. I feel like they're just, here's what we can do. And I'm not like, I get this sometimes with Michael Brecker. Coltrane, you always have the sense like he's trying to talk to God. And mostly with Michael Brecker, I have the sense that he's trying to talk to Coltrane, which is not the same thing.
These guys are, this is a band of studio musicians. You know, it is
how many
people
that are like on like 600 albums. I mean, I'm not making that up. He's on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of albums.
Oh yeah. No, so we talked, we had an episode on the alto sax or the saxophone in pop back on episode 81, and Michael Brecker appears on a couple of those, and then Randy Brecker is on Larry Coryell's Introducing the 11th House. We discussed that on episode 101. But yeah, Michael especially, but both of them, they made thousands of sessions. Brecker squeezed out hundreds of solos. And yeah, it's not as communicative. It's not quite as organic. I mean, Brecker for me is always a guy I admire a lot. And there are certainly appearances, you know, where my favorite Brecker is probably 70s ECM. I mean, he's on a couple really fine sessions. John Abercrombie's Night, he's on. He's on 8081 by Pat Metheny, which may be the greatest thing Metheny ever did. You know, he appears, but he's very much got a sideman's mentality, and that he just...
He's like a hired gun.
You know, he's in a way programmed to make a great 15-second, 30-second solo, because that's what you do on pop things. And then he does it for 8 minutes in a row because, you know, he can do it in the Brecker Brothers. You know, they give him 8 minutes, but... It's like it's all fireworks. You know, there isn't – he's used to, like, producing in a very short burst. And really it turns out if you listen to jazz solos, a lot of really great ones, the first couple of choruses are extremely simple. You know, they aren't playing a lot of notes. They aren't doing a lot of – you know, they're telling a story, and they're beginning with some basic ideas. Then they elaborate, you know. And Brecker's just like, nope, nope, it's orgasm 8 minutes long. Get ready for stinging his tantric sex, you know, buckle yourself in. And sometimes it's just a bit much. Now, I've not looked at the waveforms when I'm editing this podcast. I'll take a look. Are they solid black? I don't know. I mean, I don't know if this is compressed or whether it's just the band itself is kind of intrinsically compressed. You know, it's all kind of forte. It's all urgent. So I liked it. It was kind of cool. And in a way... Probably their best live.
Yeah. No, it's totally enjoyable. It's just a little exhausting. It's just, yeah, I get a little tired. You know, one of the things that I wished, so here's just like a path not taken. Strap Hangin', which is a really interesting song, starts out like an Albert Eiler song. This sort of, you know, it starts with this little 2-4 march, and it ends on a little 2-4 march, and I'm like,
yeah, a little march
thing. I would
have
liked to hear the Brecker Brothers cover some Eiler. Just, what the fuck would they do with it, you know? That would be interesting, because the opening and closing of Strap Hanging is really cool, and then the middle is like, it's good, and I like it, but, you know, when Strap Hanging first started, I'm like, this sounds like Albert Eiler. I mean, this really sounds like Albert Eiler. And then it goes into, then the groove starts, you know, and I'm like, I kind of would have liked to hear what they would do with other sounds of the 70s that they don't typically explore, you know, that would have been interesting, just to see where they'd go with it. You know, what would they do with, like, some Return to Forever? What would they have done with that stuff? That'd be fun to think about.
Well, you know, Eiler is, he's the Holy Ghost, and Coltrane's the Father, and again, you know, those overtones, the overblowing, it is an attempt to reach something in that tradition, the avant-garde tradition. And with Brecker, it is a gesture. You know, it's sounding soulful. And it's technically monstrous as he is, it rarely moves beyond a gesture. You know, it's not that he's gotten super excited or he's trying to reach nirvana. It's just that he could do this as one of the things he does in his solos. I think it sounds good. I mean, in other words, as a recording, it's very clear. You almost have to remind yourself it's not studio. I mean, you hear clapping, but there's not a lot of, like, there's no room ambience or anything. It's kind of, you know, just very in your face. But yeah, I agree. It's when I made my listening list for this, I broke up the two discs with something in between them just as a way of kind of, I don't think I could handle, you know, 120 minutes or whatever it is, or 90 minutes of Brecker Brothers in a row.
Yeah, they're exhausting.
Just a little bit too much.
They're exhausting. They're literally exhausting. Yeah.
You know, a while back, I thought, I'm going to try some of these 70s artists I ignored as a kid. So I got Billy Cobham. I got Brecker Brothers. And I got to admit, I kind of bounced off. You know, I'm like, okay, yeah, these are fine. I had like the last, I had Strap Hanging as a kid. I listened to it. And for whatever reason, you know, it didn't grab me. And I didn't go to their other stuff. And, you know, it's mostly Brecker stuff now. the composition are mostly Brecker, mostly Randy compositions. Strap Hanging is the rare Michael composition, but in most of their book is written by Randy. And, you know, some Skunk Funk, a couple of those have become standards, but I think it's more for kids who aspire to be studio musicians. They want to be little technocrats and master this incredibly difficult stuff. I don't know if it's as friendly to listeners as it is to aspiring musicians. Well, are you ready to move on to Sanborn?
Yeah, sure. Let's do. You're gonna save Skunk Funk for last.
Well, it's last chronologically.
Okay, that's fine.
And I also think that Sanborn is a good, you know, this is Songs from the Night Before on Elektra. When was it? The year was 1996.
1996. Yeah.
And yeah, that was, you know, I remember once reading it in the Rolling Stone record guide. They're mocking Supertramp, which is a sport lots of people like to engage in. Like, Supertramp had a saxophone player. Did the saxophone player get groupies? And, you know, that's the Brecker Brothers. Apparently, yes, they're knee-deep in women, you know? So it's like, I guess it's possible in the 70s. And, of course, Sanborn, you know, more so than the Brecker Brothers, is a handsome guy, amazing head of hair. And he basically took the Hank Crawford sound and kind of polished it a bit. And he may have had a couple more gears, technically speaking, and just made this long-lasting career out of it. We didn't talk about it in our Pop Matter episode, but Sanborn is basically David Bowie's Young Americans. He is the signifier of Philly soul that Bowie just splatters all over that record. I mean, he's playing pretty much every minute of that album. It's kind of bizarre, really. And so this is a later album by him after his 70s and 80s peak that you picked out. Just tell us a little bit about where you came across Songs from the Night Before and why you picked this one out.
Well, I mentioned before, I'm on a music trading site where you trade hard copies of CDs. So, you know, that's not file sharing. You're actually trading discs that you own. And someone had people list what they have. And Sanborn is someone who I have an abiding but not intense interest in. But since it's essentially to be on the service for someone to send you the CD is free, and I think there's a dollar fee, it's like, well, I'll take a dollar flyer on anything by Sanborn, you know, it's a dollar,
sure, yeah.
You know, and partly because maybe it's just that we are of the generation who heard that Saturday Night Live sound, and it's like in our musical DNA, and it's just, there's a certain kind of appeal. I find it it's instantly listenable and pleasurable at like just a base level. So I'll take a flyer on anything by Sanborn. I have an early, real close to Cool Jazz album by him, and I still like it because there's always some fiber there. So, you know, this, I just got this with some other stuff that came in from this trading site, and so yeah, for whatever reason, some Skunk Funk ended up back in the rotation, and I thought, all these guys play on each other's albums. So Randy Brecker's here on this album.
Yes.
He's one of the players.
Right, right.
And there's a bunch, you know, Don Alias on percussion. I mean, isn't that, like, essential? Like, doesn't he just appear on all these albums?
Yeah, they turn on the studio lights. He kind of wakes up in the corner and starts playing.
He whips out the bongos, yeah. And he's like, bop, bop, bop. You know, it's like, right on. Yeah, I just, that's where this sort of came from. And it wasn't any design on my part. It's just, you know, if I see a Sanborn album for a dollar, yeah, I'll get it. Because I know kind of what I'm going to get, and I know roughly how I'm going to feel about it. And I'm not usually surprised. And I'm not surprised here by this stuff. I like it. I think it's solid. I was kind of curious what you felt about the Wayne Shorter cover.
Thank you.
because I figured that would be your special in here. I think Sanborn, as compared to the Brecker brothers, is a little less on the wankery spectrum and a little bit more on the pleasant spectrum. Like he's more the Donald Byrd. He's not quite a Baby Oil player, but it's more about pleasure than it is about technique, right? Even though I think Sanborn has plenty of technique, I think this is about pleasing the auditors, not impressing them as much.
Right.
So, yeah, I find it quite enjoyable. It does get a little closer to the smooth jazz spectrum than anything the Breckers ever do. But there's enough of, you know, Sanborn sax always has a kind of dry sound to me. It sounds like he's, you know, being recorded in a cedar cabinet somewhere. And to me, that preserves some of the integrity here. If he was on Echo, I would start to get images of oral images of Kenny G. Unfortunately, he never has the reverb turned up. So there's just enough dry here to kind of make me cathect strongly to this. Yeah, I find it, you know, just dead pleasant. Not deep. It doesn't inspire deep thoughts. It's just like, yeah, I could drive to this late at night for hours. This is cool, man.
There you go. Yeah. As long as it's a city.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
This is not a country album. No. This is, you'd be like, I'm lost. Where am I?
It's urban.
Yes, it's urban. That's a good word. Yes.
There you go. We've talked about Sanborn before. We talked about him on episode 110, Time of the River, and that may be the one of these albums I distinctly remember listening to prepare for the podcast in a botanical garden in Sweden. And 125 Voyeur, which just as a kid I remember being in every record store and every mall I ever went to as a kid. You know, it was ubiquitous. That album was everywhere. And on one track here, Philip Upchurch, the guitar player, appears, and we talked about his excellent album Darkness, Darkness.
Yeah.
On one of our podcasts. And that is another 70s pleasure with, I think, a little more jazz content than, say, The Bird, but very much in that kind of groove thing. We talked about Phil on 165. Yeah, this one, the criticism of the time, the reviews, focused on the fact that the big collaborator on this album was keyboard and a drum programmer, Ricky Peterson. And so he co-writes five of the six originals. The other one is solely written by Sanborn, and the three covers, Spooky, Listen Here, and Infinize, the Wayne Shorter track. And so, this is a lot of the program drums as the bed. It's a fairly digital effort by Sanborn, but it's still in that kind of late night, groovy, super refined, Hank Crawford-derived sound. And it's quite pleasant. You know, it's another production. There's a number of musicians on it. Will Lee, the bass player from Brecker Brothers, appears on one track. But for the most part, it's kind of this, and Randy Brecker, as you said, was on there. It's kind of programmed bed, and then Sanborn and a couple of musicians on top of that bed playing, you know, soul originals and, you know, songs in a kind of funk, covers in a kind of funky style. And, you know, I enjoy it. He's not minimalist, but he is more a player of gesture than of just barrages of notes.
Right.
And you can kind of understand, it's like, you can imagine, you know, this is a soundtrack for a seduction, or as you said, driving down the city lights at 3 a.m. Whereas the Brecker Brothers, I always kind of wondered, you know, who was the audience for this? Was it solely band camp kids? You know, who bought these records? And that really it was about this kind of technical wankery, and I there's an audience for that, but it's as much for them as it is for the listener, but in a different way from the, you know, I don't know, the average jazz album, which, you know, a lot of jazz music you'd argue is as much focused on the musician's needs as the listener's. I would, you know, that's not an indefensible position, but this is a little bit more music for use. You know, it's kind of grooving, hanging out, chilling, hanging with your lady, hanging with your guy.
If you were driving,
and you were channel
right. surfing, and you heard this, you would think I've slipped into either some what people euphemistically call urban programming, which is code for black programming, right? Or, you know, I'm listening to potentially kind of a smooth jazz station. Whereas if you heard the Brecker Brothers, right, you'd think you were listening to a soul funk station. You wouldn't listen to this and go, oh, I've got the funk station, right? I'm going to hear some, I'm going to hear
it's
some,
less.
Yeah, right? So this is a whiter sound, maybe, in some ways, I might initially say.
Right.
Yeah, this is not a value judgment, but this is a whiter sound in some ways. It's, yeah, and it's, I could see why Sanborn gets on some people's nerves. The Penguins don't like this much. They say there's no pressing reason for this album to exist. I'm like, well, that's a little harsh.
Say commerce?
I don't think that's fair, you know, I mean.
David's mortgage?
David's mortgage, David's cocaine habit, whatever, you know, there's a reason for this album to exist. But, yeah, whereas with the Breckers, there's always this sense of, the technique, the fire on display there is its own reason for existing. Like, when you hear it, you'd be like, oh, right, they're here to show you some shit. When you hear Sanborn, it's like, it's not like he's saying, I'm here to show you some shit. He's like, I'm here to entertain you. And sometimes as an artistic agenda, that can feel shallow, I think. I think the Penguins grade him down because of that. And I don't know that that's entirely fair. This is perfectly pleasant. Like I said, reverb has a lot to do with it. If there was reverb here, we're in Kenny G land, and I'd be very unhappy. But there isn't, and so somehow it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, Sanborn, there are times I feel like listening to this record, it's like he deployed a lick. He did something that he's done before, and it fits. It's tasteful, but it doesn't sound at the moment or particularly urgent. And, you know, both him and the Brecker Brothers, you know, as a kid, I used to listen to the Blues Brothers soundtrack. And then at some point, you're like, this just isn't okay. I mean, these are just bad white imitations of African-American artists. Now, I don't think, you know, the Blues Brothers were just, you know, they used great backing band, but as singers or whatever, they're just imitating people they admired. I mean, it wasn't the real thing. I don't think it's fair to say that of the Brecker Brothers or Sanborn, but they are both coming out of African-American traditions and somehow finding a way to more successfully commercialize them. And I don't know whether it's because it's a paler face on the cover of the record or whether it's because they know some code that the way to present urban music for people that white people like as well. I mean, I think they certainly have an audience in the African-American community. It's not like no one would listen to them or something, but it's just a weird thing. And I guess you could say that of all jazz, but in a way, there's certainly a lot of white artists who you feel like are kind of negotiating between, say, European models and African-American models and trying to find some middle there, where this is, it's very much just based on, you know, what was going on in Ray Charles' band or whatever. And I like it. I think it's well done. It's certainly back when Elektra existed and would release, you know, a instrumental album. There's no vocals on this. You know, the Brecker Brothers had a hit. East River apparently charted. Which is interesting because the song makes no fucking sense. It's just gobbledygook. But, you know, they actually had some kind of chart action on that album, or that song, rather. And, Sanborn, he toys with vocals. Sometimes he gets artsier. Sometimes he's more in this bag. I don't dislike him, and I like Night Music when he was the host of that. And, you know, overall, he seems like a decent note. I don't even know if he took cocaine. I'm pretty sure at least Randy Brecker took some cocaine. I would not be shocked if Michael did. I don't know about David, probably, but you know, he seems like a nice guy. But yeah, the music, it's fine. I'm not a collector, but you know, it's cool. So are we ready for Randy? Are we ready to get Randy?
Let's do Randy. This is a weird album.
It is, because, yeah, so Some Skunk Funk is Randy Brecker. He brings Brother Michael on. He plays a couple tunes that you will hear on the Brecker Brothers Live and Unreleased, which he wrote. And the album's, he's with the WDR Big Band. Will Lee is on bass. Peter Erskine is on drums. The Brecker Brothers on horns. So there's like a sub combo about the size of the Brecker Brothers ensemble, you know, six or so. And then there's this big band. And I'm not going to list the names. There are some very fine European musicians who I've never heard of. And they're very accomplished. And it starts off like a big band version of the Brecker Brothers.
Yep.
But I feel like it takes a swerve and gets a lot more ambitious as it goes on. And some of these tunes are nothing like the Brecker Brothers. And much more about texture and about, you know, structures that go beyond funk vamps. So it was a little hard to get hold of, but I thought it was an interesting record. Talk a little bit about Randy and the boys playing that skunk funk.
So what's kind of interesting is, so the arranger here, which we haven't mentioned, is Vince Mendoza. It feels like someone has made an organic effort to marry the funk sound of the Brecker Brothers with a properly arranged big band. And they've made like a real effort so that the big band is not merely a kind of replacement for the electronic groove engine that one normally gets on a Brecker Brothers album,
right?
They're actually, they're arrangements, you know, and they have things to do. It's not just a bed of, you know, it's not just a bunch of trombone, it's not just a bunch of brass and reeds sort of giving us the replacement for the synthesizer. They have a kind of organic role to play here. And this is dead interesting. I don't quite know how I feel about it yet, because it's as if what they've done is they have a big band, but they've outsourced all the soloing to the combo, right? So the Breckers, Will Lee, and to a lesser extent, Beard on piano, and to a really lesser extent, Peter Erskine on drums. They get the solo moments here, as far as I can tell. And everyone else is kind of there to serve the combo's interest, but serving the combo's interest isn't, these arrangements are kind of interesting. They're not, it's not just background. Like, they're vibrant. They have a lot of energy. They have a lot of fire. And then they drop out for, they fade to the background a lot of times. And then it really is just kind of the combo. So I feel like that the marriage isn't quite, it's not quite done. When it is at its most organic, I like this better. So for example, on their version of Strap Hangin', we don't get the Albert Eiler March intro. We get this, we get this flat out fucking fiery arranged, you know, ba da ba ba ba, you know. Yeah, Tonight Show band tearing it up. And then about, I don't know, 2 minutes in, everyone fades and it's now the combo with Michael Brecker solo. And it's, and so I guess I kind of like the moments where the marriage between the combo and the big band feels more organic and authentic as compared to moments like this where the band sort of fades, where the, a big band fades and it's
right, just kind of steps back and disappears. And
so when it's all together, I feel like now we got something. And then when it turns back just into the combo, I'm like, okay, I've heard this. I kind of wanted them to keep doing the combo shit, combine the big band with the New York players in this more organic, interesting method. The closest thing I can imagine to this working would be, if I don't know if you remember, there's a Sam Rivers album late in his career arranged by Steve Coleman called, I forget the name of the album, but it's something called the Riv Bia Orchestra. So it's a big band for Sam Rivers, and everyone gets like two bar solos, and they marry the big band sound with Sam Rivers' frenetic form of late bop improvisation. And I remember thinking that was the shit. And I kind of thought sometimes that's where this was headed,
But then the big band takes a back seat sometimes, and I kind of wanted their marriage to just be more thoroughly organic all the way through. So I prefer the moments where it feels organic. Strap Hang is a good example where it doesn't feel fully thought through. I don't know. What did you think?
I was a little surprised by the ambition of the Charts. And again, because they front load a couple very Brecker Brothers tunes, at first I was thinking, oh, this is just the big band Brecker Brothers. And then I realized, no, you know, when you get like Wayne Out. Which is Randy's homage to Wayne Shorter, you know, that right there, that title is going to warn you that it's going to be a little odder and more ambitious than the typical funk track. Yeah, I thought overall it was interesting. I mean, one fault of this episode has just been that we're doing a lot of the same thing. So it's like, there's only so much Brecker I can take in a given week. You know, I was like, okay, because I was going to queue up this playlist as a random thing to listen to at the office. And I just realized it's like, I think I know these albums well enough, but I hope I do because I can't do this. I've got to stop. I'm for various personal reasons, I'm super screwed up right now and super tense. And, you know, there's just a lot of anxiety subconsciously going on with me. So whatever. But yeah, I needed something calmer. But that said, yeah, this is, it's ambitious, it's interesting. And I was thinking there's something about the fusion era that seems to lend itself to big band treatment in a way that nobody who's not been brain damaged wants to hear big band kind of blue. You know? Right, you know, I mean, it's a no. But so many of the fusion bands are a little bit more regimented, a little bit more about arrangements and about technical display, and that scales up well. Whereas you cannot reproduce very effectively in 99 times out of 100, the organic interplay of a small group. You know, you can't get the Bill Evans Trio as a big band, right? Just no. The whole point, you know, but the Brecker Brothers, yeah, that concept, why not? You know, it's not like there's a lot of ebbing and flowing and kind, you know, and a kind of pastel shade. No, it's like, it's all kind of pretty laid down, fairly rigid, fairly arranged. And, you know, hardcore blowing, which works fine in the big band context. The same Zanuel, they did, there was big band arrangements of his stuff for the Weather Report years and after. I don't know if they've ever done Mahavishnu Orchestra, but I don't see any reason you couldn't, as long as the band was, you know, the orchestra was super technically accomplished. You know, I feel like it would scale up. Whereas I don't want to hear scaled up Blue Note albums. I really don't want to hear the Sidewinder with 20 pieces. That's not a good idea. So, you know, the concept works, and Brecker, Randy Brecker, is kind of an interesting composer. I feel like he is the band leader, the project maker, more than Michael. I mean, you know, Michael's leader dates are fairly thin on the ground. And, of course, then he dies pretty young. Randy is born 45 and is still with us. Michael, 49, and dies in 2007. Sanborn, I believe, he's born 45, so he's exact contemporary with Randy. So this generation, they're all 12, 15 years older than Donald Byrd, or younger than Donald Byrd. You know, not quite a full generation, but getting there. Yeah, this album kind of is an interesting highlight because, to me at least, when I think of the Brecker Brothers, I tend to think of Michael first as the outstanding player of the two. But this is a reminder, as really the live album of the Record Brothers, that Randy remains the composer and conceptualist of the two. So, yeah, it's different. I think that these guys were excited, the WDR band. I'm going to suspect many of them listened to the Brecker Brothers as kids. You know, they're exactly, it's an accomplished band, kind of, any big band anymore is kind of a studio artifact or an artifact of, you know, they're not like touring around or something the way Count Basie was in the 30s, right? You know, it's people that can play at a super high level, and the Brecker Brothers are idols for those kind of people, right? They are the ultimate expression of the brilliant, versatile studio trained musician who can, you know, play in any context and can burn. So yeah, I liked it. You know, it goes on a bit, and it's a little odd. And as you say, some of the arrangements kind of fade away, and some of the stuff is a lot more ambitious and out than other stuff. I mean, it's hard to put, you know, Wayne Out or some of those other more adventuresome songs on the same album as some Skunk Funk and have it all gel. So any more thoughts about the Breckers?
Nope.
And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 195. This time we're going to skip Pop Matters and put it together with a little discussion of mine on some box sets I've acquired as a separate standalone episode, basically because the summer gets confusing at times, and I'm guessing at some point or another we're going to need a bonus episode in the chamber. So look forward to that, unless it's happened already, in which case I hope you enjoyed it. As always, you can reach us at pat@jazzbastard.com or theoretically mike@jazzbastard.com. You can drop me a line on Facebook or look me up on All About Jazz. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com, from Stitcher, from Apple Podcasts, from Mixcloud, and you can stream it at All About Jazz. Tune in next time as we explore some of the roots of cosmic jazz, looking at works by John and Alice Coltrane, Lonnie Liston Smith, Pharoah Sanders with Sun Ra, and Brandy Younger. Until next time, take care.